Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. There's a song, "We All Live Downstream," and for many in Appalachia, living downstream can have toxic consequences. And there's a new book about that. Chris Marr is a Pittsburgh-based staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He writes about environmental issues, coal mining, politics, regional economics, and other topics. And he is the author of Desperate, an epic battle for clean water and justice in Appalachia. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Chris.
Thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate your interest in the book and this story as well.
Well, Chris, the book may be nonfiction, but it does read to me like a novel full of really compelling characters and events. And as your subtitle suggests, it's about this epic battle for clean water and justice in Appalachia. It's a battle that's all too familiar for many communities in eastern Kentucky. If you could give us kind of an overview of the story that you tell.
Sure. So the story, it's really about people who live in four communities in Mingo County, West Virginia, who had been living with contaminated water for years. So for some people, some of the problems started way back in the 1980s. And by the early 2000s, many people in these four communities just outside Williamson, West Virginia, had gray or rust-colored water coming out of their taps. The water was often smelling like diesel fuel or chemicals. It was kind of stinking up their homes. But more seriously than that, people were getting sick. They realized they were getting rashes, diarrhea, kidney stones, even cancer. You know, they started to link problems in the communities with people's health to the water quality. And for years, really, they had been struggling with the water. I mean, went far beyond an inconvenience in your home, you know, where you can't necessarily take a shower. You've got to use this water to clean your dishes and do your laundry. So they were trying to get a water line for years. They were trying to get the county and state officials to help fund a water connection to either the city of Williamson or Matewan, which were the two nearest towns. And they just couldn't get that done. And the nearest company, Massey Energy, which had a subsidiary called Raw Sales and Processing nearby, had denied that it had affected anybody's wells or the well water in the area. So the people were really stuck. And by the year 2004, they turned to an environmental lawyer named Kevin Thompson, who eventually sued Massey and fought the company for 7 years. He was living and working out of most of the time out of the Mountaineer Hotel in Williamson, which is right on the Tug Fork. And so the story largely is focused on this lawsuit and everything that people had to endure, what Kevin Thompson went through suing Massey.
A couple things about this book, Chris, that I think it's important to point out to our listeners, especially in these times. And it has to do with sourcing and fact-checking. For example, I know that out of 340 pages, 13 pages are devoted to sources, chapter by chapter. And you had help with fact-checking as well. Briefly, if you could, just because I think people are interested in this process, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, you know, I've been accustomed to fact-checking my own articles. But when it came to writing a book-length piece of work, it was a whole order of magnitude far beyond what I'd done before. So I recorded all of my interviews. I tried to talk to as many people as I could on both sides of this lawsuit. People who are involved, you know, as the residents and then lawyers on both sides and experts. So I was able to transcribe those interviews. And when it came time to check the story, I was able to go back and quickly search through that. But I did have to hire a professional fact checker as well. So we worked for several months. And this was an entirely new process to me, but we went through essentially line by line in the book, checking all the facts, and he would look up independent sources for things that he could find, you know, factual things like how much coal was mined in a certain year, how much, what were Massey's profits in a certain year. And then I would provide him with sources too. I provided him with company memos that I'd acquired, correspondence between state regulators and the company, and just various things that we were able to go through. It was a pretty arduous process, I would say. It was, but well worth it because, you know, I wanted everything to be buttoned up on the story.
Sure. And I just wanted to emphasize that for that reason. I think it's really important. Okay, let's talk about Kevin Thompson. Tell us about Kevin Thompson.
So Kevin Thompson is an environmental lawyer. He grew up in West Virginia And so I'd just like to say, too, one of the fascinating things about reporting this story was that you had Kevin Thompson, the environmental lawyer, on one side, and Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey, on the other side. And they were both incredibly complex and compelling figures. But one thing I noticed in the reporting was that they also shared these similarities in some ways, as different as they were as people and, you know, a lawyer versus a coal executive. They both had been born in West Virginia. They both went to Marshall University. Both men had early parts of their careers where they spent about 10 years outside of West Virginia. And then they came back, and it almost seems as if they were sort of destined to meet one another, the crusading environmental lawyer on the one hand and the coal baron or the coal executive on the other. And they did meet face to face in a dramatic scene, which takes place midway through the lawsuit. But just to give you a little bit more about Kevin Thompson, he's not your typical lawyer. He is he worked out of this, you know, old hotel, the Mountaineer, which when he first started living and working there was really run down. I mean, there was very little heat in many of the rooms. The carpeting was non-existent. The hotel was in the process of being renovated. And so it was very bare bones existence for him for years and years. But he is also he's a brilliant lawyer. He's very charismatic, and he drew a young staff to this mission kind of that he had against Massey Energy. So they lived and worked out of the hotel together. You know, as I said, he's very different from Don Blankenship. Kevin Thompson was really connected to his clients emotionally. He got to know these people really intimately and became almost an extended member of some families. And, you know, that took place over 7 years where they were fighting the largest coal company in West Virginia in coal country, you know, in this place where Don Blankenship was extremely powerful at the time. The company had a lot of sway. And, you know, you had this environmental lawyer in this hotel fighting the company. So he really poured everything he had. I think he poured, you know, his finances. He went broke several times fighting this lawsuit. He put his marriage at risk. He even his health at times. And I think it was the defining case of his career as an attorney. So it was, you know, just a remarkable story for him as well.
On the other side, of course, were the coal companies. How did they respond?
So Massey fought back immediately. The company denied that it had affected anybody's wells or the aquifer in the region. And I had the opportunity to interview Don Blankenship in person, which was, I was really happy to be able to do that because, you know, I think in a lot of these stories that involve water contamination or a lawyer fighting a company, very often the CEO is not in the picture. It's kind of this faceless corporation. You don't know who is making decisions. But in this case, it was just incredible that Don Blankenship was the CEO of this multi-billion dollar coal company, Massey Energy. But at the same time, in the 1980s, which was the same period that Kevin Thompson was researching and digging into the company's history to see what had happened in this area to potentially affect the water. At that same time in the 1980s, Don Blankenship was running that subsidiary. So he had, you know, an intimate connection to this, to the lawsuit from the very foundation of the claims in the case that the company had contaminated the water. And when I talked to Don Blankenship, you know, we went to his house in the area. He lived in the area, as opposed to other coal executives who might have moved to like Richmond, Virginia or St. Louis. Don Blankenship grew up in Mingo County. He continued to work there and was very closely involved with running the company. Very dedicated in a way to Appalachia and to the region. But when I met with him, he said that, you know, he didn't think the company had affected the water, had been degraded over time by a century of coal mining in this area, basically. So under these communities, there are layers of abandoned mines in the different coal seams. But, you know, that's not what Kevin Thompson concluded based on his experts and his own testing. Thompson's conclusion was that the company did, in fact, affect the water in the area, and the hydrology and the people's wells. And Thompson pinned it on the slurry injection that the company had done for years in the 1980s at that time when Don Black Chip was head of that subsidiary.
Talk a little bit more about that, about the disposal of slurry.
Well, your listeners may be familiar with what happens with coal slurry when it's placed in an impoundment, because there was that incredible Massey disaster in 2000 in Martin County when this major impoundment broke through. The slurry, which was sort of it's kept in a lake-size impoundment, you know, busted through the bottom of the impoundment into abandoned coal mines and out the side of a hill and down into some creeks. And you know, I think it was 20 or 30 miles where the creeks were contaminated. One thing Thompson discovers is that there was 1 billion gallons of coal slurry injected into this very small region.
Wow. I did mention earlier that we were going to talk about one particular home as an example of what was going on with this tainted water, the home of Ernie and Carmelita Brown. And they made it made quite a strong impression on Thompson, didn't it?
It did. First of all, Ernie and Carmelita Brown, they lived outside one of these four communities. And they were a couple that noticed these problems earlier than most people. And it probably was because of the underlying geology and just how the groundwater flowed in that area. And so one night, Carmelita turned on her bathtub to have a bath, and the water just came out gray. And they just, she and her husband Ernie stood there and just to see if, you know, is the water going to run clear again? And so for years, you know, it was kind of an on again, off again thing, the water, but progressively the water did get worse. And by the early 2000s, there was this hydrogen sulfide gas from the water in their well. And people told me that when they opened the door, they were just hit with this smell that was almost unbearable, you know, to step into the Brown's home. It just had this strong, strong odor that was hard to tolerate. And the thing was, the Browns had become desensitized to it. But at the same time, they knew, you know, Carmelita was getting kidney stones, and their family was getting rashes and gastrointestinal problems. And you know, they even had things corroding in their home because of the gas. The levels were so high that, you know, some of the wiring in their home was corroding. So, you know, Ernie said to me, you know, if this is what it was doing to, you know, the wiring in their walls, what do you think it's doing to us?
Yeah, really.
So they're throughout the book kind of, and the progression of the lawsuit, and they were one of the families I talked to the most, and they really had gone through quite a bit through this whole process.
Thanks, Chris. The book is a real page-turner. That's Chris Marr. He's a Pittsburgh-based staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal and author of Desperate, An Epic Battle for Clean Water and Justice in Appalachia, published by Scribner. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Drinking water in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia contain contaminants that exceed safety standards, according to a new study from the Environmental Working Group. Corinne Boyer has more.
Environmental health nonprofit The Environmental Working Group released its latest data available on its tap water database on Tuesday. The organization sets its own safety standards for contaminants, which are much lower than legal federal limits. Many small West Virginia utilities that serve a few thousand people or less have been in significant or serious violation of federal drinking water standards over the past 3 years, according to the tap water database. Tasha Stoiber is a scientist with the Environmental Working Group.
We do recommend that people filter their tap water. It's a great way to reduce your exposure to a lot of these contaminants. And featured on the database is a drinking water filter guide, where you can learn about the different types of filter treatment technologies and what contaminants that they filter out.
Stoiber says filtration systems can be expensive and inaccessible. She says stricter policies would help limit exposure to chemicals. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Corinne Boyer.
You can check the tap water database in your zip code at ewg.org/tapwater.
We all live downstream.
Better watch out what we put it in.
We all live downstream.
Let's be careful what we do.
We all live downstream.
Better look out how we're using it.
We all live downstream.
And the stream is running through. Through the mountains, through the valleys, through the cities, through the towns. Through the wild places where the water falls down.
Jim Justice, governor of West Virginia and owner of several mining companies, has announced the reopening of four mines in Kentucky. But as Katie Myers reports, an active lawsuit and a new report indicate concerns that this could be a strategy for further delaying overdue coal mine reclamation responsibilities.
Coal production is up 46% this year in Kentucky, and as a result, Justice-owned companies are planning to reopen four previously closed mines in Pike, Knott, and Harlan counties. Altogether, these mines could provide Kentucky with 150 new jobs. But there's another side of the story. The state of Kentucky has been in litigation with Justice since 2015 over delayed reclamation on several mines in the state, including two of the mines he's reopening. Kentucky's Energy and Environment Cabinet alleges that Justice has not properly stabilized the old mine sites, leading to potentially dangerous outcomes for communities nearby. Advocacy group Appalachian Voices recently released a report detailing the potential jobs that could come from reclaiming Justice's mines. Willie Dodson wrote the report.
Reclaiming a mine is what the company is supposed to do to abate those concerns for nearby communities.
According to the analysis, reclamation liabilities total $5 million across the Kentucky mines that Justice owns. Dodson's report estimates that completing the reclamation work would employ 220 to 460 workers for 5 years. Dodson also calls for stronger enforcement by regulators.
These companies' pattern is to ignore obligations until bond forfeiture or some other type of strict enforcement is imminent, and then strike a deal with regulators to buy themselves more time. Often, after the fact, they just continue kicking the can down the road.
In 2019, Kentucky regulators had moved to revoke permits to Justice's Kentucky mines and asked a judge for $3 million in fines. Dodson says the reopening of these new mines may be just another way to get out of paying the state, pushing reclamation further down the road.
Jay Justice has just made some new promises, but the Justice companies have made countless promises that they have not honored over the years.
Justice previously promised to stabilize the Infinity and Bevins Branch mines in Pike County and Harlan County by June 2020. That date has now moved to April 2022. He says he will begin hiring for the reopened mines soon, though no start date has been announced. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Katie Myers.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and WEKU. What is biochar? How's it made? How's it used in agriculture? And how can it help with climate change? All questions we had for David Butler, head of sustainability at Altec, the Nicholasville-based animal feed, meat, brewing, and distilling company. And full disclosure, this conversation was taped for the Altec blog and shared with Eastern Standard. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So let's begin with those basic questions. And first, what is biochar and how is it made?
Well, biochar is very similar to charcoal, really, but charcoal is specifically used as a fuel, and biochar is not. It has lots of other uses, but it's biomass that has been baked at a really high temperature in the absence of oxygen. So it's essentially kind of crystallized carbon. All of the volatiles are driven off, and you're left with this very, very porous piece of carbon.
Any idea who had the eureka, for whom the light bulb went off, how the process was discovered?
Well, I think people have been making charcoal for thousands of years, probably, as a fuel. But also, there are a lot of places in the world, especially in the Amazon, where you can find that biochar was used as a soil amendment. And it might have been an accidental discovery. They would kind of bury and burn their waste. So they would be burning waste without oxygen because they were burying it. And you find soils there that are very rich and black, even hundreds and or thousands of years later. And that's called terra preta soil, black soil. And that's really how they fed a very large population there, by enhancing the very poor Amazon soils with biochar.
So they burned their trash and then buried it, and it continued to burn. Is it possible for that to happen without so much oxygen?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it doesn't actually burn in a lack of oxygen environment, it undergoes a process called pyrolysis, which is P-Y-R-O-L-Y-S-I-S. And what that involves is kind of breaking down this organic material, driving off the volatiles, and reducing it pretty much to carbon and minerals. So it's not burning, because burning does require oxygen, and at the end of it, you're just left with carbon dioxide and ash.
Huh. So when you dig it up, what does it look like? What are the properties? What can it do?
Well, it really looks just like charcoal. And, you know, you could have relatively large pieces, or it could be almost, you know, a microscopic size. And if you look at it under a microscope, you'll see that it's very, very porous. And if you think back to high school, maybe you looked at plant cells under a microscope, right? And so you know what that looks like. There are all these kinds of spaces that are mostly liquid in the middle of the cell, and then you have the cell walls. Well, you can imagine if you baked that at hundreds of degrees, you would drive off all of those liquids and volatile compounds, and you would be left with kind of the skeleton of the plant matter. And that's really a major important property of biochar. It's that it's so porous because it's this organic matter kind of crystal carbon skeleton. And because it's very porous, it has a huge surface area. So it can hold a lot of water, but it can also hold nutrients like nitrogen, calcium, potassium, phosphorus. It can even hold toxic metals and kind of bind those up. And it's also a great home for microbes. It's kind of like a little apartment complex for microbes.
Huh. So lots of implications there. Let's look at a big one here. According to the International Energy Agency, global warming could be kept to 1.8 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels if all the pledges and the promises that were made at that recent summit in Glasgow are kept. And scientists have said that warming needs to be kept at 1.5 degrees or below that to avoid the most disastrous climate consequences. But 1.8 degrees is still big news, given that right now we're actually careening toward a 2.7-degree rise. So to what extent can biochar play a role in helping us get a handle on that rate of increase in warming?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Tom. And I think that a lot of people are trying to figure that out right now, because even though biochar is a very, very old technology, the biochar industry is relatively new, and they're growing, and there are a lot of exciting things happening with the industry, but it's still in its infancy, really. It's still kind of tiny. So estimates for the amount of carbon that could be sequestered by biochar range from 1 gigaton to 35 gigatons per year. And that's a huge range.
Yeah. What about agriculture? There are indications that it's already being used in farming. Is that correct?
Yes. And, you know, it's been used for a long time by farmers. And I think it's getting more awareness now, and it's starting to spread. And one of the fascinating things about biochar is that because of its properties, it has many, many uses. So there are a lot of ways to use it in agriculture.
Well, let's explore that a little bit. When biochar is worked into the soil, let's say, what are the benefits to the farmer?
Well, I mentioned that it holds water and nutrients, and it also is a place for microbes to live. It's like a little ecosystem for microbes. So all of those things are beneficial for the soil. And first off, if we talk about water, if you have all these little pieces of biochar in the soil, they kind of act like little sponges, and they hold water, which means that under times of drought, you have all of the water that's been saved in the biochar. But also, when it rains very hard in an extreme weather event, then the soil can hold more water. So there's less runoff, and there's less erosion. So it really helps with resilience on the farm, especially as we're seeing more weather extremes due to climate change.
We hear so much about these large lagoons, especially in swine production. And so what about manure management? How can biochar make a difference there?
For one thing, you can take the manure and convert the solids from the manure into biochar. So that's huge because it allows you to stabilize all the carbon and the nutrients in those manure solids, and you're reducing the volume of them. And so you have a lot less material to deal with. And once you've converted it to biochar, of course, there's no odor. It's not going to leach any nutrients. And you end up with this very valuable product. As a result, you have the biochar. And you can take that biochar and put it on your manure lagoon. You can use it in your bedding for cows, and that helps keep them dry and helps with hoof health and things like that. Then you can also take it and spread it on the fields. And it's great to mix it in with the liquid portion of the manure that's going to be injected into the fields, because it helps to absorb methane and hydrogen sulfide, and most importantly, ammonia. It keeps that manure from off-gassing ammonia, which means that you're keeping the nitrogen in the manure, which makes it a better fertilizer, which means you don't have to use as much synthetic fertilizer.
It sounds as though we've finally found a way to literally make a silk purse out of a sow's ear.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy.
Well, there seems to be a lot of excitement about biochar in the dairy industry. What's driving that enthusiasm?
Well, I think one really exciting thing, there are some people working on projects where they build small biochar kilns on a dairy, and they take the manure solids and they convert those to biochar. And in the process, they get renewable energy, because when you heat the manure, you also get synthetic natural gas, you can get bio oils, and then you can take those and burn them to make renewable electricity, or you can convert them to diesel fuel or natural gas for heating or for transportation fuel. There are even some companies working on a biochar process to produce green jet fuel.
I'm just sitting here listening to that, David, and thinking about the broad implications of what I'm hearing. And it sounds to me as though we're talking about the possibility of an alternative to fossil fuels and a renewable energy source that could be in abundance and could be quite helpful in approaching this whole climate change issue.
Yeah, it's certainly a very exciting piece of the puzzle. You know, I don't know that it's going to solve all of our problems, but it's a technology that's, you know, it's available right now, and we just need to scale it up. And in sustainability, people love to talk about things that are a win-win. Well, biochar is kind of a win-win-win-win-win. Like there are so many benefits to it, and you're getting renewable energy as you produce it.
So it's an alien word at the moment, an alien term at the moment. Do you see the day when we're going to be talking about biochar as something just normal in life?
Yeah, I think so. And another good indication that that's coming is that Microsoft and Shopify recently included biochar in their net zero plan. They're buying biochar credits already.
How about that? Well, let's keep following this.
All right.
All right. That's David Butler, head of sustainability at Alltech. Thanks for joining us, David.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
$4.5 million. When somebody asks you how many people live in Kentucky today, there's your answer. And more Kentuckians have made the move from small towns and country to cities. These trends show up in the latest census numbers. Daily Yonder editor Tim Marama has pored over those stats and joins us to talk about the details. Welcome back, Tim.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be with you.
And we hear and read about the ways the pandemic may have affected this most recent census count. Is it too early to know, though, whether that turned out to be the case, that it was impacted in some way?
Well, my understanding is the folks who were out there collecting the forms it came right in the middle of the pandemic. The guess would be that there'll be some kind of impact, but it's really hard to say exactly what.
The state of Kentucky as a whole did have some population growth in this past decade. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the state increased by about 4%. The rural areas did not increase at all, dropped just a hair. And the larger areas, Louisville, Northern Kentucky, Lexington, and then also interestingly in the smaller metro areas, like Owensboro, population growth was substantial there. Bowling Green, those areas grew by 8.3%, while the rural areas were flat or dropped just a little bit.
Out migration, as we call it, has long been a concern in rural areas and particularly in eastern Kentucky. What do these new census numbers say about that?
The area of Kentucky with the largest population decline was definitely eastern Kentucky. I looked at 33 counties that would loosely configure as eastern Kentucky. Those areas lost 4% population. It's not a huge number because it's only about 750,000 residents overall, but it dropped from 755,000 in 2010 to about 723,000 in 2020. You know, in contrast to that 4% decline, the Bluegrass and the Knobs counties around it grew by about 7%. Of the counties where we had the worst population loss, 14 of those were in eastern Kentucky. So it really was this kind of the center of population decline.
And where did you see the most loss of population?
Well, Bell County, Middlesboro, was the biggest decline. It was down 16% from 2010 to 2020. Owsley County, which already had a relatively small population, it declined 15%. Knott County, Hindman, was down 14%. McGoffin, Martin, Letcher, Wolf, all eastern Kentucky, kind of Coalfield counties, were down from 11 to 13%.
And Tim, can you talk a bit about the implications of that? When a county loses people, when they leave, something else goes with them, revenue, right?
That's right. And the thing to remember is that this is not a new story. I mean, I remember growing up in Jackson County in the 60s, you know, people left for Cincinnati. They went where the jobs were and they weren't where I lived. And in the coal counties, the employment peaked sometime around World War II. So we've seen a decline for generations. So it's not a new development. Reading, writing, and Route 23, as the great country song says. But what has happened over the years is that at a certain point, you probably reach a threshold where it feeds on itself, I would say. And so some of these counties are going to have a hard time with the school system, with keeping up the public utilities, those sorts of things that come from local tax revenue and from having, you know, young people and a variety of workers in the area that support those activities.
On the other hand, did any eastern Kentucky counties buck this trend and gain population?
Yes, absolutely. The I-75 corridor going into southern Kentucky, Laurel County has been kind of on the uptick for a while. They were up 6%, that's London. And Whitley, just to the south a bit on I-75, was also up some. We also saw an increase of like 4 to 6% in counties in eastern Kentucky that were relatively close to the Bluegrass. And some people might even put them in the Bluegrass category. Montgomery, Rowan, Powell, and then Lawrence was also in there. It was up by 3%.
These numbers can be used to kind of create a portrait of a place like Kentucky. And I'm just wondering, what do you see, Tim, in these census stats that tell you something about the diversity of Kentucky's population?
Well, diversity increased from 2010 to 2020. And that, again, is part of a national trend that we see more people of color and more Hispanics, which is coded as an ethnicity in the census data. This occurred in Kentucky. The Hispanic population grew from about 1% of the state's population. It grew about 56%, so we're up at about 3% now. In eastern Kentucky, we also saw growth in the Hispanic population. Now, it had a relatively small base in 2010, so you don't have to have a lot of folks coming to the area or being born into the area to have a percentage increase. But the Hispanic population grew by 30% in these eastern Kentucky counties I looked at. They were 1% of the population in 2010. They're 1.3 now. Those aren't huge numbers, but it does indicate that these large trends we see nationally, that we're not isolated from those. We're part of those large patterns. And so those changes are happening even in the rural parts of Kentucky as well.
And do you have graphics and articles, for that matter, on the website that our listeners can go to for more information?
Absolutely. We've got a map that shows nationally kind of the gainers and losers in population. You'll spot eastern Kentucky right away. And then another thing that we did nationally was looked at how metropolitan status affected population change. And basically, the larger the city, the larger the population growth. And that's part of what we see in Kentucky, too, is this migration from rural areas to metropolitan areas generally. So we've got information about that on the national level, too.
Okay, and we'll revisit this topic from time to time. It takes a while to analyze these numbers, doesn't it?
Yes, and there's more to come. The interesting thing will be to look at, they track what part of this population change came from people migrating to or from a county, and what part occurred because of childbirths and deaths. And that will reveal what the character of the population loss is.
That's Tim Marima. He's editor of the Daily Yonder, and you'll find it online at dailyyonder.com. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Tom.
They learned reading, writing, Route 23 to jobs laid waiting, the city's factory. They didn't know that that old highway lead them to a world of misery. Have you ever been down Kentucky way, say south of Prestonsburg? Have you ever been up in Holler? Have you ever heard man cough his life away, digging that black coal in those dark mines, those dark mines.
Kentucky's 5th Congressional District lost 5% of its population over the last decade. That has implications for how the area, represented by 21-term Republican Congressman Hal Rogers, will look after political redistricting next year. But Capitol reporter Rylan Barton wondered what's behind the district's population loss.
First one to the top wins. We will come back to the championship race tomorrow.
Children race woolly worms in Beattyville. They place the orange, brown, and furry creatures at the bottom of a taut string, and when they get the okay,
race is starting. 3, 2, 1, race it, go!
They try to goad the worms up the strings by blowing on them with straws or clapping.
Worms like noise.
This is the Woolly Worm Festival, where the 1,300-person town in Lee County jumps by about 10,000 for the weekend, but the county's population has dwindled by 6%. Since the last census, about half of Kentucky's counties did, most of them in the eastern part of the state. The worst drop was in Bell County on the Virginia border, which lost 16% of its population. Rick Nelson is the mayor of Middlesboro in Bell County.
You know, a lot of the coal miners, when they lost their jobs, they moved out, their families went off to school and just stayed where they were going.
Nelson was a state legislator from 2001 until 2018. He says he feels like he didn't do enough to prepare the area.
Because I just thought coal would be forever. I just didn't think there was no way you could do without coal. And that was always going to be something we could hang our hat on. I was wrong on that. A lot of people were, too, and that don't make me feel no better about it because I admit it, but that's just the way it is.
Matt Ruther is the director of the Kentucky State Data Center. He says it's part of a national age-old trend, population declining in rural areas and increasing in urban and suburban ones.
What's happening is these counties are aging, so the populations are getting older, and there's fewer births to sort of replace this older population. And people are migrating out to where there are more numerous jobs.
It's especially pronounced in eastern Kentucky because of the collapse of the coal industry, which dominated the region's economy for more than a century. But demand for coal plummeted amid cheap natural gas prices and growing awareness of climate change. The entire industry only employs about 3,900 people in Kentucky now, down from 20,000 10 years ago. Dee Davis is the president of the Center for Rural Strategies in Whitesburg. He says the coal industry can't sustain communities in eastern Kentucky anymore.
We used to think that coal was the only thing we had of value, and so we had to exploit it, or timber was all we had, and we had to cut down the trees.
Davis says the region needs to embrace alternatives, building broadband networks so people can work remotely and connect to markets around the world, embracing local art and culture, and strengthening the education system.
What's valuable is communities who can work together. What's valuable are young people who are smart and enterprising and problem solving. And so in a way, for these communities to thrive, we got to have a different attitude about keeping people around and making it a place where people who have gone off and done well can also come back and find a way to contribute.
Even though statewide, Kentucky's population increased by 3.8%, Eastern Kentucky's 5th Congressional District dropped by 5%. That means the district will have to change shape when lawmakers draw new political maps next year, growing in size to stay proportional with the state's 5 other congressional districts. And in the legislature, there's going to be fewer districts in rural parts of the state. Here's Middlesbrough Mayor Rick Nelson again.
I think Eastern Kentucky is going to lose, and Western Kentucky will lose some, and then your population centers, Bowling Green, Northern Kentucky, they'll gain more and have more influence.
And while legend has it the woolly worm can predict how severe a winter will be, there's no telling how severe redistricting will be for the region next year. I'm Ryland Barton in Beattyville.
If you close your eyes and listen, some sort of deliverance happens when you hear a recorded voice from another time, even another era. An unfiltered, unedited voice of the past can establish context and credibility. People sharing their stories in their own words with their own voices through their own understanding of what's happened and why. Neil Kasiak is immersed in this world as an oral historian here at Eastern Kentucky University. I came across Neil after learning of the place where we find him now, the William H. Burge Oral History Center at EKU, and I wanted to know more and thought you might too. Thanks for joining us, Neil.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So first of all, what does an oral historian do?
The short answer would be, you know, we document accounts of the past as they're remembered by those who experience them. We conduct unrehearsed and recorded interviews with individuals that can cover, you know, a person, a place, an event, or more general experiences. The general overall goal that all oral historians are trying to reach towards is we're trying to create historical records for public and researcher use and for posterity's sake.
Well, I was about to ask you about the significance of oral history and why it's important to preserve these voices.
We all learn from a young age, you know, through oral traditions. That's how we learn language, from communicating with others. Oral traditions in themselves are as old as humanity. And from a historian's perspective, you know, historical research and historical narratives have oftentimes followed the great men theory and following the big events and the big actors that are sometimes erroneously given ultimate credit for big changes or big events through time. And the power of oral history, in my mind and in many other oral historians' minds, is that, you know, documenting these stories of regular people democratizes the historical narratives. And in many respects, the modern oral historian really is bringing forth voices that have been silent in historical record for as long as history has been recorded in many respects. I think that aspect of really bringing forth voices of common people, as well as people that are in bigger roles, I think is probably the biggest power that oral history has.
Is there a science to it? Is there a particular way to go about conducting an oral history interview?
You know, there really is a craft, and I'm sure you can attest to this, Tom, that interviewing people, you have to be a kind of a social creature. You got to really have a knack for striking up conversations and asking good questions that evoke deep responses. The biggest thing is coming in well-researched, as well as having a knack for knowing when to be silent. I think that's probably, you know, the skill that's the hardest for oral historians to learn. You know, our first inclinations in social situations and talking with people, especially about topics of importance to both the narrator and the interviewer, is moments of silence. When you allow the person that you're interviewing to really kind of dig deep into their memory and reflect on their experiences and then pull those out of their brain, because that's what oral history relies on. You know, it's the experience and the memory that's left in people and the way that they view whatever topic it is that you're talking about. And allowing that space to let things come to the surface is one really, really important skill in being a good oral historian.
What sorts of treasures might we discover there at the Burge Oral History Center?
We have a wide range of collections. A big part of our collections are Eastern related, and then the service region of EKU, so the 22 county service region. And so we got quite a few coal interviews that address coal, as well as, you know, different aspects of Eastern Kentucky heritage and culture. We have a variety of smaller projects on people like, you know, Bert T. Combs and Martha Lane Collins, the first female governor of Kentucky. There's also more recent projects. Since I came in 2015, there's a lot of collaboration with faculty in the community, as well as student projects. That's one thing that I focus really heavily on, is the instruction side of providing instruction and information to students to become good oral historians and good active listeners. I think that's one of the things that oral history really has to offer the world, is that, you know, it's asking people to listen to others. And so we have a small towns collection, which is hundreds of interviews with people that lived in small towns in Kentucky. And one of my predecessors, Dr. Bill Ellis, had his history students in one of his courses go out and interview people that lived through the Great Depression. Mm. And so our Great Depression Memories collection it's got a lot of content that has captured a lot of perspectives that oftentimes has been written about in different publications and research. But to really hear those voices and hear, you know, the resilience in people that lived through the Great Depression, for example, is really connects with the humanity side of people when you really sit down and just listen.
Well, I had asked you to pick out something that we could listen to, and of course these are long, extensive interviews, so it's hard to find something that can just fit into a brief interview like this. But as I understand it, you have done that. What are we going to hear?
I chose to take a lighthearted approach to your request for this little clip, and it's an interview from the Kentucky River collection that we have here. The interviews were collected by Bill Ellis and Todd Mauberly, and they were looking at people who lived and worked on the Kentucky River. And the particular interview clip that I selected for your listeners is a man by the name of John Herod. He's a pretty well-known musician, a fiddler, and he tells a really interesting story, and I think your listeners will enjoy it.
Okay, let's listen.
Manon Campbell told this story. He was in it. He was 86 when I visited him, lived up on Line Fork, which, okay, that runs into the North Fork. But Manon Campbell had this tune he played that he called Coal Harbor Bend. He said that was named after a bend in the river. And I have a map, an old bargeman's map of the river, and I couldn't find any place called Coal Harbor Bend, but this could have been, you know, the name might have disappeared, or it might have not have come up on the map, because there hasn't been a whole lot of barge traffic on the upper part of the river. But Manon Campbell tells a story of how that tune got its name. These men were going down to they were rafting down the river, and it was, I guess, a log raft, and it was night, and it was dark on the river, and I guess there was they could see enough to keep going, but they were going down the river, and they heard a big square dance, sounded like going on in this cabin on the bank, and fiddler was playing some kind of tune. Everybody seemed to be having a good time, and they floated on a ways, and before long they came to another square dance, and the fiddler, pretty good fiddler, and they floated on a while, and they came to another one, and then one of them noticed, well, seems like every house in this country are having a square dance. Somebody else said, yeah, by God, and it says, sounds like a fiddler's playing the same tune, too. Every house in this country, what about that? So they kept all night long. That kept happening. The next morning, the sun came up, and they noticed they're in a big whirlpool right there, just going around a big circle. And that was the name of that place was Cold Harbor Bend.
So Neil, tell us about the center's work with veterans.
I'm super proud of this project, and I was asked to teach a veteran studies course by the veteran studies founder, Dr. Travis Martin. And the capstone assignment for VTS 200 is we educate our students on veteran identities and the full spectrum of diversity of the identities in people that make up the military. And then we ask them to go out and identify a veteran. Oftentimes it's family members that, you know, our students might have wanted to talk to about their service and their military service, but didn't really know how. We ask them to contact a veteran and go out and speak with them and conduct an oral history interview with them. And to date, we have about 600 interviews or so that students have collected. I mean, the depth of this collection is really impressive. And, you know, the online and kind of e-campus reach that EKU has with VTS as well, it's not just representative of our region in Eastern Kentucky. I mean, we're capturing veteran experiences from all across the country.
Okay, well, I hope that we here at Eastern Standard from time to time can dip into your collection there and share those voices with our listeners. Looking forward to doing that.
I would love to contribute.
That's Neil Kasiak at the William H. Burge Oral History Center here at EKU. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett producer, Neil Kesterson producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.